This is Melissa Peskin, Dr. Peskin, as many know me. I'm a OBGYN general specialist and hospitalist, and I have been doing my job for the better part of 15 plus years. And I want to welcome you to my first podcast, Pearls of Wisdom. I spend a lot of time telling stories about my past to help guide my junior colleagues through the trials and tribulations of patient care. So I thought, what the hell? I'd try my hand at reaching a wider audience. And that's going to be you. This podcast may not be for the faint of heart. No. In fact, anyone who's made it through an OBGYN residency is not faint of heart at all, as I think many of them would agree. As a former classmate of mine once said, this residency takes guts, aka intestinal fortitude. And that, listeners, is what I believe all OBGYNs share, because as we well know, any patient who crosses our paths can take a turn for the worst on a dime. We must rush into action to save their lives. Indeed, every OBGYN saves a life every single day, and that takes courage, passion, and yes, intestinal fortitude. Albert Einstein famously said a lot of things, but I especially like, I have no real talents, but I'm passionate and curious. Now, I think I actually have some very specific, excellent talents, but I'm also passionate and curious. Passion, contrary to some straight-laced thinkers, can be an Achilles heel, but I think they're misinterpreting that for impulsiveness. Anyway, I totally wholeheartedly disagree. Passion is what keeps the spark, keeps people on their toes, paves the way for the future, discovery, curiosity. It avoids the mundane status quo from dominating the public space. Passion is arguably the fire under knowledge and experience. I suspect this podcast will eventually become more comedic in tone as my compadres and I share gory stories we remember about residency and beyond. But to begin, I plan to share with you little pearls of wisdom I learned along the way. Peskin's pearls, some of my residents say. Everyone is on a journey, and no one teacher can speed that journey up for people. But they may be able to make one's individual journey a little more smooth. Any teacher has offered a pearl of wisdom along the way, just to make learning a little easier, the subject matter a little more relatable, make that learner, that trainee, not feel so alone, make them feel maybe a little more sane. So for my first episode, I plan to share some of my thoughts and considerations regarding medicine and OBGYN in particular. I hope that these musings reach you where you are and that you find one or more of them helpful on your journey. This morning, now watch me step. The week was murder. I'm gonna get rid of the stress. I'm feeling lighter. I'm finally feeling like I can breathe. The night is calling. We're rolling downtown. We're grooving to the sun. We're rolling downtown. Yeah, so I think the first thing I would say to any OBGYN in training, and even after, beyond, is be tenacious. Revile mediocrity. Ugh, mediocrity is the worst. At least that's what my mom said. And in my old age, have come to believe it. Thus, always aim for excellence. There's no reason you can't do better next time. There's nothing that is absolutely perfect, and therefore there's always room for an opportunity for improvement. So please, always aim for excellence. Your patients and you and your integrity deserve that. Meanwhile, maintain humility throughout residency and thereafter. There's always more to learn and more to grow. Anticipate potential complications and speak up. You can prevent complications this way. So, as I used to say to people, if you see something, say something, right? Just like the New York City subway. Always be thorough in your exam and assessments. Leave nothing to uncertainty. If you just subject discomfort to ascertain information, then explain this proceed. For an exam that does not produce thorough findings was not worth it. It was not a worthy exam at all. So you have to be intentional about what you're doing. Anytime you put your hands on a patient, you must be intentional. Ask questions. Ask yourself, does this make sense? What's the rationale behind this? What are the pharmacokinetics? What are the side effects? How often do I dose this? Where does this even come from? Where does this idea come from? Do I just do this because somebody told me to do it? Or is there evidence backing this up? This goes back to being curious. Ask a lot of questions, okay? This will help actually make your job more interesting and more validated. Read after each encounter. This tests your baseline knowledge. The reading will invariably be associated with a patient's face, especially if you're reading about something you saw that day. The colleagues with whom you shared the experience will forever be with you along with that patient and that interesting scenario. And those feelings you had at that time, that's always going to stay with you. That will stay with you forever. You'll never be able to lose those feelings, those associations. And you'll be more likely to retain information that way. Don't just read in isolation. Always try to associate with a patient experience. If you see a constellation of symptoms as part of a syndrome, then you're probably on the right track. 2 to 3 separate problems are often not individual. Sometimes they can be, but always look for relationships between problems and complaints. As much as we all love zebras, and any one of my co-residents would attest that I am the zebra-loving zebra queen, remember that horses are much more common. So always look for the horses, and if you don't find them, then go chasing down those zebras. Always stabilize mom before you intervene for baby. Fetal status is a fifth vital sign, and usually, outside of there being a primary problem with the fetus, usually the fetus will recover once mom is stabilized. For example, please avoid crashing a seizing or immediately post-eclamptic patient until she is stable. That's a pretty good example of when people get their head in a tizzy. So try to keep calm. Okay, if anyone else has read The House of God, in The House of God, among so many just brilliant pearls, they say, you know, during a code, the first heart rate you take is your own. Try to keep a level head during an emergency. Your patients deserve that. And everyone will fall in line and follow suit because they see how calm you are. So try not to crash a patient unnecessarily. It really is to the detriment of the patient, I promise you. Stabilize her and things will work out better. Okay, so we're gonna move on to what you do when someone is fully dilated. So here's a couple of pearls because we get ourselves into a lot of trouble, or at least I see junior attendings and residents get themselves into troubles in the second stage. So for example, the first thing in the second stage is never turn your back on the second stage, a fully dilated patient. Reassess them every 30 minutes and their exam will most certainly change. If their station didn't change, she probably has more caput. There's probably some molding. Be tenacious in your assessment of her abdomen and the fetal head. Your evaluation can be the difference between a safe delivery and a horribly morbid one. Always take the fetal status into account and don't overlook that in the interest of just getting a vaginal delivery. Now, anyone who knows me calls me the vaginal delivery queen because I have done most of my quality and safety and research in trying to prevent unnecessary cesarean sections and safely reduce the NTSV rate. This is honestly what I'm most passionate about, but I really try to set forth a message never to lose sight of the bigger picture. The section rate should never be zero. It shouldn't even be 5% or 10%. Honestly, anything closer to 24% is probably best for mom and baby. So that's like 1 out of 4 women. Unfortunately, most section rates in institutions are higher than that, like 1 in 3 or 1 in 2 women, which is really horrible. So, you know, in an effort to improve our vaginal delivery rates, we do have to be intentional and evidence-based in our management of labor in the second stage. So, you know, this is where this sort of recommendation of mine comes from. Be tenacious in your assessment, okay? So examine the abdomen. Do you see a Bandel's ring? Examine the fetal head. Is she asynclitic? Is she OP? Is she OT? Is her pelvis terribly small? Or is there a lot of edema? Has she urinated in a while? What's going on with that? But also, obviously, you know, make sure that the fetal status is reassuring to continue. With that in mind, always reassess a para-zero patient pushing for over 1 hour. This is the optimal time to rotate a occiput posterior patient who's the right candidate. If you want an amazing study to reflect on this or look further, look no further than The Persistent OP by Dr. Barth. This paper is one of the most amazing papers I've ever read. It is, it really speaks to the art of medicine. And I just cherish Dr. Barth for writing every single word of that article. So I'm not going to get into OP so much, but I can tell you that a P0 should, if she continues to be OP after an hour, it's called persistent OP. And this is the optimal time to rotate the baby if she is a good candidate. This avoids potential complications, maternal exhaustion, the baby from getting too impacted. And the same goes for a P1, however, about 30 minutes earlier. So if she continues to be persistently OP after 30 minutes of pushing with little progress, then that would be a good time for you to try to manually rotate. Okay. Assuming she has to go for section, document the position of the fetus before and after delivery. This is really important, especially with an arrest of dilation or descent, because this is going to be extremely helpful during her next pregnancy for her antepartum counseling regarding how we counsel for potential for VBAC. Be as descriptive as you can, because that really informs the next physician about how to counsel the patient. And document any other abnormalities at the time of section. Don't just, you know, plug in the template. This is lazy, and rote templating use threatens the sanctity of patient care and the value of the note altogether. If you do not remark on the unique surgery, you may as well have not written the note, in my opinion. You know, you should try dictating. Dictating is actually pretty awesome in that you have to really think about what you're saying. But if you don't want to dictate and you want to use the templates, at least really treat every template, every op note, you know, uniquely. For minimal variability, scalp stim is awesome because in lieu of, you know, fetal scalp pHs, this is a good way to assess for reactivity of and reassurance of your fetal status. And you can do this every 30 minutes in the setting of minimal variability. Now, please don't do scalp stim during a deep decel. Everybody wants to stim the scalp during a big bradycardia or a decel, but this causes the fetus actually to vasovagal and makes the decel worse. So actually try to avoid aggressively stimulating the fetus during those situations. In, let's say, a 30-weeker on magnesium with a flat tracy, consider to turn off the mag to assess for fetal status, assuming mom can tolerate that. But that if you are concerned about the fetal pH or the, you know, the acid-base status of the fetus and whether you can continue with your induction, consider, you know, giving the patient a mag break for a minute. Again, only if she can tolerate that or if that's safe for her. All right, moving on to postpartum hemorrhage prevention and treatment. For PPH prevention, okay, when to prevent hemorrhage from uterine atony, go ahead and use 200 to 400 mics buccally as soon as the baby is born, along with the Pitocin. This is a dual agent use for the active management third stage of labor. This is prevention, so 200 to 400 mics buccally. If you are interested, Dr. Dial performed a study recently looking at the efficacy of this for prevention and noted a huge statistically significant difference in hemorrhage rates. Now, you can get unfortunate fevers or shaking afterwards, but at these lower doses, it's less likely. And I will say that having implemented this in my practice, it's been a game changer. Now, for postpartum hemorrhage treatment, use meso 400 mics sublingually. The buccal does not have the same pharmacokinetic response as sublingual. And when you have hemorrhage, you really need that explosive tone. And you get that from the high plasma concentration due to the sublingual absorption. Do not confuse buccal and sublingual. They are different. Buccal has a huge layer of mucosa separating the medication from the vasculature, whereas the sublingual is right up abutting the vessel underneath the tongue. But the WHO and FIGO has recommended use of 800 mics of meso. However, these tend to cause really adverse side effects like very high fevers and shaking. And so I don't actually use that. I find that I get just as good a response with 400, so half the dose, with fewer adverse side effects. And of course, in our high resource settings, we tend to have other medications available like Methergen and Hebivate or TXA or Morpid or something. So, and even Jada's and Bacri's. But anyway, that's the story about misoprostol. So for prevention, use it buccally. For treatment, use it sublingually. All right, what do you do with a PROM? You pit a PROM, pit a PROM, pit a PROM. How many times do researchers look for a different way to successfully induce a PROM? I don't know how many times you can look for a different way, but Pitocin over and over has been proven to be the gold standard for inducing a PROM, even with an unfavorable cervix. So just do it, I say. Okay, this is sort of switching gears. Cytotec does not treat retained products or retained placenta. In fact, one of the reasons you might have a retained placenta or retained products is that you have this little, vessel, like feeding vessel, which if you use Cytotec, it could break it off. And I've seen somebody exsanguinate. So really, if you have retained POCs, offer surgical management. You won't regret it. Methergen is amazing for lower uterine segment atony. It causes the uterus to hold on to everything. So don't expect it to ever help you expel anything. Just remember that Methergen is great for holding the uterus nice and tight, but it's never going to get something, from the inside out. All right, what's next? Okay. I love to say this to people. Be efficient in the OR. Time equals blood equals more complications. The uterus cries bloody tears every time you poke it unnecessarily. So anticipate and plan your needle exit as much as you plan your needle entry. Okay? Really respect the tissue. People take for granted that the uterus is such a sort of resilient organ, but you need to treat it gingerly. And we do so during a hysterectomy, for example, in GYN, so why not during cesarean? All right, what do I got next? Refine your fundamentals and always restore normal anatomy before proceeding with surgery. This is super true in both GYN and OB. Remember that restoring normal anatomy is of the utmost importance. Okay, in a repeat C-section with very dense adhesions, find a window to deliver the baby. Don't go on an expedition or wild goose chase for adhesion release. And don't forget about the baby. The longer the baby's under spinal, the longer it takes to get out, the lower the gases will be. So find your window, deliver your baby, and fix the rest later, obviously avoiding the bladder when doing so. Find your window and deliver your baby. All right. Similarly, when you cannot access the lower uterine segment due to adhesions, do not perform a mid transverse or high transverse hysterotomy. This is actually not a thing. You're going to want to choose classical incision. And while it might hurt you, it's not going to hurt the patient and certainly not going to hurt the baby. This is easier to deliver the baby. You're less likely to have significant bleeding or injury to the lateral vessels. So always choose classical when you cannot access the lower uterine segment. You might also be able to get away with like a midline or like or a low vertical. But there are many reasons this incision, the mid or high transverse hysterotomy is a terrible idea. It's not a thing. So don't do that. All right. When you're closing hysterotomy and fascia, which are both crescent shaped wounds, one thing a mentor of mine taught me a long time ago was to use parallel stitching. So everybody wants to go perpendicular to the tissue, especially at the apices where it sort of is a little bit curvilinear. And this leads to actually poor closure approximation of the tissue and therefore not a reliable closure. If you look at the mouth of the Cheshire cat, you can see that the lines are all parallel. And that's sort of how you want to mimic and close the hysterotomy. Once you do it, you'll see what I mean. But anyway, try not to go in at a 90 degree angle at the angles because you'll end up with more tissue on the bottom and less on the top. And I don't know if anyone's ever told you this, but they used to when I was a resident, make up room and you just don't get an even tension across the fascia. And that's the most important layer. All right. Speaking of hysterotomy, have you tried VLOC to close hysterotomy? What? Okay. There are so many reasons this suture makes so much sense for hysterotomy closure. It's already used frequently for myomectomies, but it's the suture of choice already for vaginal cuff closure. Bladder repair, GU uses it all the time. And most of the layers used by plastic surgeons actually employ VLOC. This suture is kind of so brilliant. I don't know why it took me so long to consider using it. I have been closing my hysterotomies with a running non-locking zero Vicryl for many years now, and I find excellent hemostasis. You don't have to lock your hysterotomy. In fact, many people around the world do not lock their hysterotomy. This has been shown a single non-locking layer gets excellent hemostasis and has been shown in several papers to actually lead to less sort of necrosis of the tissue and a thicker segment when closed in one layer. Anyway, if you've been doing that like I do, the transition to using VLOC was really sort of straightforward and understandable. So, I just started using VLOC, and this was based on a study done by Dr. Buckley and Stone, who presented at SMFM and showed that VLOC on hysterotomy saves both time and blood loss at time of section. And I was like, woohoo, let's go there. Let's do it. So I have been doing it, and I have not looked back. It is fabulous. As the uterus involutes, why wouldn't you want a suture that holds on tightly to the tissue? For everyone who's concerned that the suture loosens as the uterus gets smaller as it involutes, you don't even have to, I don't think, worry about that because the barbed suture will stick to the tissue. For me, this makes so much sense. VLOC is safe. I think it has really good outcomes in this setting. And however, you cannot extrapolate for use on the fascia. VLOC is actually not approved for fascial closure, so do not use it for that layer. It has been used on scarpas. It's been used in the deep dermal. It's been used in other settings, but it has not been used for the fascia. There are other barbed suture companies that are approved, but specifically VLOC is not. Anyway, I'm a big fan right now. VLOC, non-locking, running for hysterotomy. Try it. It's beautiful. All right. I didn't tell you this earlier, but I actually do, I'm a simulation, director at my hospital. And so I run in situ simulations. And, I believe that simulations are really great for team dynamics. So I stress that during an emergency, the entire team needs to work together. And in doing so, a team leader has to identify themselves. So I'm a big fan of the chief OBGYN, either a chief or attending, identifying themselves as a team leader and maintaining volume control of a situation. The team leader is a dynamic role, but it's an essential one. And the team leader doesn't have to have all the answers. They're generally a communication liaison. Having a team leader has like someone central who everybody can sort of communicate to, and it keeps the emergency at a level that is sort of ideal for the team to function, and it's better for the patient. So remember to always keep the patient in the center of any clinical situation and look to the foot of the bed. That's where your team leader should be. All right. In an emergency, be it triage or the LDR, do not forget about anesthesia. Often they're the last to be told once you're rolling the patient to the OR during a bradycardia, but they should be the first people you call, right? During a bradycardia, they should be first, whether you go to the OR or not. Sometimes they can fix the blood pressure, but anyway, if you do end up in the OR, those are the people you really need because you want to be able to load the patient's epidural if she has one in order to avoid general anesthesia if you really have to do an emergency section. Anyway, always call anesthesia. Call them early. They'll never be upset. They're upset when they get to the OR after you and don't know that you are in there. They do not like to be the last to know. So anesthesia needs to be notified early. Don't worry about a false alarm. If you decide not to section the patient, so what? They're there. They know. They saw the patient. They're aware that, you know, of what's going on. It's really a win-win situation. All right. With regards to your surgical skills in GYN surgery, I recommend that, you know, everybody like practices and refines them and learns, you know, new and novel surgical technique in GYN surgery. But when they get to C-sections, people sort of paw their way through a C-section, which gives obstetricians a really bad rap. I personally recommend that you use your cesareans, which come along more often, to refine those surgical skills. It's like literally a lab where not only are you obviously operating to deliver your baby, but you can actually treat the tissue with respect and use those fine GYN surgical skills and put them to good use. Never take shortcuts. You want to be efficient, but don't take shortcuts. That goes for surgery and medicine in general. Use economy of motion in your surgery and be economical in your movement outside of surgery, in triage. You know, when you're trying to juggle a section and a delivery and the people coming in through triage and the phone calls, be economical. You know, figure out who comes first. Always be, you know, moving the blocks around. We're OBGYNs. We got to move at a fast pace. You can't be moving slow and not expect some terrible emergency to walk through the door and derail everything because you were lollygagging. So when you call a section, move the section. When you want to manage labor actively. When you see a patient in triage, get them in. If they need to go home, get them out. You know, don't be lollygagging. Honestly, it's just going to bite you in the butt. All right. Make sure your notes are succinct and that the assessment and plan reflects everything that's in the subjective and objective. Auto texting and auto filling endangers a full assessment. It's also really terrible for learning. So, you know, if you're going to use that, which everybody really does now that everyone has EMR, ensure you're actually reading your notes and that they're accurate. The biggest thing that I see over and over is people actually sign their notes without vital signs or a physical exam, or they haven't actually verified somebody's patient history. I think today a C-section that went in had patient had irregular menses as her active problem list. I think that probably has not been an issue for some time, being that she's 38 weeks pregnant, but, you know, there we are. All right. That goes back to never taking shortcuts. Anyway, remember the patient. Always tell her results, give her anticipatory guidance, engage her in her care, and be her advocate and engage her trust. Really, your patient is why you're here, and don't forget that, all right? Obviously, it's a job, but this is a life calling. At least it is for me, and I think it is for a lot of OBGYNs. Most people don't enter this field, you know, for the paycheck alone, and certainly not the hours. I mean, we're up all the time. Day or night, we have to be alert and on our toes, so might as well do a good job. All right. Mostly, be honest with yourself. Be honest to yourself. Be honest to the patients and your team. Honesty and integrity are the cornerstone of being an honorable and trustworthy physician. If you don't know something, acknowledge it and learn it, but never fake it and never lie. Finally, my last words of wisdom are to be curious and be passionate. These two attributes are the fuel you need to be a great physician. Don't ever let someone tell you that passion is a bad thing. Passion is an amazing thing. I wish everyone had passion. So be curious and be passionate. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for our next episode where I'll chat it up with some of my compadres and we'll reminisce about stories to which I hope you can relate. All right, adios.